Again to BadQuaker.com podcast for Friday, September 14th, 2012. This is podcast number 205, and my name is Ben Stone. We're actually recording this on Thursday because with me is Jake Shannon, host of Mental Self-Defense Radio. And Jake is a person that I've often said is the most interesting man in the liberty movement. And you're going to find out why I say that. And I guarantee you're not going to disagree with me when you get done listening to this podcast. As I said, Jake is the host of Mental Self-Defense Radio. That's Monday through Wednesdays, 1 to 3 o'clock in the afternoon Mountain Time in Salt Lake City on one of the oldest talk radio stations in America. In addition to that, Jake is the chairman of the Libertarian Party of Utah. He is a former investment banker. He has written a bunch of books, a few of them that I'm going to list here: Endonomics, Default, Deflation, Derivatives, and the End of the United States as We Know It. And that's only about 100 pages. You can grab this book off Amazon with the link at badquaker.com, and you can just read it in an afternoon, maybe on a long flight or something. He also wrote Teocon, The Hijacking of Liberty in America. He wrote The Hypnotist, Healer, Head Hacker, and Headliner. He wrote Anomaly, Revolutional Knowledge in Everyday Life. And we're going to talk about some of these other topics too. He wrote a book called An Introduction to Vintage Jiu-Jitsu. He wrote The Classical Pugilism and Bare Knuckle Boxing Companion. He wrote Say Uncle, Catch as Catch Can Wrestling, and the Roots of Ultimate Fighting, Pro Wrestling, and Modern Grappling. He wrote The Handbook. Are you getting tired of all this? He's written a lot of books. He wrote The Handbook of Authentic Indian Club Swinging. Now, when you're talking to Jake Shannon about authentic Indian club swinging, you're not talking about sequin dresses, flashing lights, and a heavy beat. What you're talking about is a spectacular form of martial art that to watch Indian club swinging is just amazing. And he also wrote the book The Sport of Catch Wrestling, The Certified Catch Wrestler Handbook, and he's the founder of Scientific Wrestling. Jake, I'm so glad you came on the show. Welcome to BadQuaker.com.
Hey, thanks a ton for having me, Ben. Man, you make it sound like I've been busy or something.
Yeah, you're one of the most busy people in the Liberty Movement right now.
Well, and I like that, man. I might have to use that. I might have to quote you that I'm the most interesting man. I'll play like that Dos Equis music in the background, but the most interesting man in the Liberty Movement. I appreciate that. I've always enjoyed watching your posts on Facebook and your podcast and stuff, so I'm thrilled to be here.
Well, thanks. I appreciate you saying that. Also, for the listeners, if you go to the grocery store and you're standing in the aisle there, look over in the gum section and you'll see Stride Gum. And you want to pick up a package of Tropical Trance Stride Gum, and you'll spot it right off because it kind of looks like a black and white swirly, almost a Target-like thing. And you pick that up, and you open it up. Well, pay for it first. And open it up, and look inside, and you'll see the image of Jake Shannon.
Yeah. It's pretty crazy. I didn't even know that had happened. My wife was on Facebook, and a client of hers in her business had sent her a message like, "Is your husband inside every pack of Stride gum?" And we just like were looking at each other like, "What?" And I guess one of some of the photos I'd done some stock photography because I am a hypnotist. I left investment banking with utter disgust, and now I think I've actually found my true calling. It's kind of sad because I'm one of these people that spent $50,000 to get a graduate degree or whatever in a field, but I was miserable. I was making a ton of money, but now, yeah, hypnosis is kind of my passion. That and libertarianism, spreading the gospel of liberty or whatever you want to call it. But yeah, it's funny because I did this stock photography to just get some cool pictures, and the photographer did some great stuff. Well, I guess he was able to sell the photos because I don't own the rights to them. I just own – I can use them for my own ends. But then the agreement was he could sell them, and he got me in there. So it's me and Sean White, that super excellent world-class snowboarder. We're in all the different packs of Stride Gum. Kind of crazy how that happened.
That's wild. It's a shame you don't get some money for it, though.
You know, whatever. I mean, yeah, I'd like to. I've actually talked to him. I'm like – I've tried to pitch them, and they haven't said no. So you know how this kind of stuff goes. But I'm like, look, guys, let me, you give me a good chunk of change, I'll throw a big wrap over like a tour bus, and I'll hit all the college campuses, and we can do the Stride Tropical Trance comedy hypnosis tour or something. I give out packs of gum and promote your thing. So who knows? I haven't heard no yet. So
that would be a huge hit.
It would be fun. It'd be super fun. I mean, I really love the hypnosis. It's it really is a passion. I've dabbled in it since I was 16. When I was a teenager, I had cancer. I had Hodgkin's lymphoma, and my oncologist at the University of Colorado Med Center suggested that I look into hypnosis to help manage the pain. And I've just been fascinated with hypnosis, with words, with this fine line between, you know, control and the automatic, and how that plays out in all its various forms, including politics. I mean, I think that's ultimately why I'm a libertarian as well.
You know, I was going to talk to you about hypnotism in the second segment, and I was going to talk to you about your book in this segment, but
sure.
Do you mind if we switch that, and let's just, since we're on the topic of hypnotism?
Yeah.
Now, you have a tremendous story you referred to there of how you got into it. You overcame cancer at a very young age. And you tell the story because that's just amazing.
Well, I in the introduction to my book, The Hypnotist, the one that you mentioned earlier, I recount the story. And to be honest, you know, I was watching. I'm really into this TV show Breaking Bad because I look at it as like if we took Breaking Bad and took all the violence out, it would be totally like a libertarian story. But
yeah.
Anyway, I was watching that and seeing the character, the way it was written, it really resonated with me. It was quite emotional because I think I'd kind of packed away some of the stuff, you know, like almost like post-traumatic stress. You kind of pack it away and you don't want to deal with it. And I was like, you know, I need to write about this. And so it was very powerful because I think that, you know, hypnosis has such a weird reputation and probably, you know, justifiably so. And this is why I wrote the book, because I think that people don't give it enough respect, and it's a real thing. And this is the funny thing because, you know, here I am, I have a Master of Science in Financial Engineering, which is basically, you know, financial mathematics. I've worked professionally as a statistician, as a quantitative analyst in investment banking, mortgage banking, all that kind of stuff. And I've left all that, and people look at me like, are you crazy? You know, but they look at me like I'm like some weird, like I'm hawking crystals or I'm some weird magician or selling snake oil or something. And I try to tell them that, you know, hypnosis has been accepted by the American Medical Association since the 1950s and the British Medical Association since the 1950s. It's very, very powerful. Sure, you can't, you know, and I'm guilty of doing the stage shows. I do tour around like we were talking, like I'm pitching Stride on doing this tropical trance comedy tour. I travel around and I do comedy hypnosis shows, so I'm guilty of kind of giving it a little bit of a, you know, that Vegas-y kind of reputation. But it is so incredible when you look at the medical applications. And my book, The Hypnotist, it breaks it into three parts. The subtitle is Healer, Head Hacker, and Headliner. That last part, Headliner, is talking about, you know, the history of it as an entertainment form. Mark Twain actually has some history with hypnosis, and I recount some of these stories. The second part is Head Hacker, and that talks about the antisocial uses of hypnosis, the kind of political applications, from how simple orators from, and I hate to make the analogy, but I'm going to do it just because I don't know a better way to do it, but just to rip the Band-Aid off, but, you know, from Hitler to Obama, say, these people who can get people so amped up, and it could be a pastor, you know, as well. I mean, it's these people who are able to use language to affect compliance in people. Mm-hmm. And there's other antisocial uses as well. We know that MK Ultra, and this is from the church committee again. I mean, people get all whacked out and stuff, thinking you should have a tinfoil hat. But these are facts. These are documented government memos that talk about this. And in the book, I do pride myself in all my books of having kind of a real kick butt bibliography, and not one like referencing like Alex Jones or Rents.com or something, but actual FOIA, Freedom of Information Act documents, or medical journals and things of that nature. And then the first section, though, is about healing. And I think this is really where hypnosis is not given its due. It is so powerful. And you see some, especially with pain, you see these other organizations using it, like HypnoBabies and HypnoBirthing. It's pain management. And you can go on YouTube, and people who are allergic to anesthetic, you can see people who are particularly talented at being hypnotized can have full abdominal surgery without any anesthetic.
Now, we could really do more than an hour just on this topic, and I would love to actually, in this open invitation, I'd love to have you on for a full hour just to talk about hypnotism, because it's really fascinating. And like I said, I really think most of the public misunderstands what it is and how powerful it can be. I'd like to ask you about something that happened recently, and something I've referred to pretty frequently, and that's the one lone crazed gunman. Is this completely is there any plausible argument to say that someone who behaves like that may have some type of a controller? Is that a crazy statement, or is there some kind of actual science there?
You know, there's tons of science there, and that particular case. Now, here's okay, and I keep referring to all these books, but this, I write these books for a reason. So my book Anomaly is actually about epistemology, which is the theory of knowledge. How do we know what we know? Okay, because I'm not interested in conspiracy theory at all. I'm not interested. Please, you know, go pitch it to somebody else. However, I am very fascinated by conspiracy evidence. And unfortunately, so much of conspiracy evidence gets thrown out with just these labels, these words. And again, just like hypnosis, they call something conspiracy theory, and then people are like, yes, conspiracy theory, I will turn the other direction and not look at that. You know, it's ridiculous, because with this Batman shooting, there are so many anomalies, and that's why I named the book Anomaly. These things that don't fit with the normal narrative. And that's kind of what the whole field of anomalistics is about revolutionary science. The fact that there's these paradigms that we get used to, and then there's these little cracks in the story that don't make sense. And as you start looking at those cracks or anomalies, you eventually have to disregard the old paradigm and adopt a new way of thinking. It's kind of like the Copernican revolution, or, you know, the quantum revolution. These are the things that we have to, if you're sincerely interested in truth and honesty and in topics in philosophy, you have to be brave enough to look at this kind of stuff. And the Batman shooting reeks of all kinds of problems. I mean, real bad problems. First of all, a lot of the testimony coming out of Denver was that there were multiple people that somebody had let this guy in to the building. Second, that some of the smoke canisters or the chemical grenades that were being thrown from the opposite side of the theater, from where the James, whatever his name was at. And then we also have to sincerely look. Nobody actually saw this guy's face when it was happening, because he had the gas mask on. So there, I mean, right, these are things that we have to apply the rules of evidence, not only like forensically in law, but also the rules of evidence like we do in science. And we can't just get caught up in the narrative, especially these official narratives. Anytime I see the word official, I'm just like, I almost automatically just throw my hands up like, boy, that's a bunch of, you know, I almost cussed there, but, you know, a bunch of BS.
Yeah, and you know, you don't just see this, one, like you're talking about the anomalies, you don't just see this in one isolated case. If you did, then you could say, well, that's one isolated case. But when you start seeing a pattern of the same the same situation happening at key times with key people, it's kind of hard not to realize that you're seeing a pattern.
Well, and we look at somebody like this, and I can't remember his last name, but James, do you know his last name? It's just slipping my mind right now.
I can't remember it.
But this guy that's supposedly the alleged Batman shooter, and again, as always, a lone gunman nut, you look at his background, the fact that he's like a PhD candidate in neuroscience, which if you go and you look, I mean, I think it was The Atlantic did a really great expose on Ted Kaczynski.
Yeah.
How he was actually a test subject in psychological research at Stanford, and how that largely probably caused him to turn into a terrorist. So, and we also know that there's tremendous evidence that guys like Sirhan, there's many psychiatrists and psychologists that are raising their hand bravely and saying, you know, this guy is showing all the signs of having been manipulated, having been hypnotized, or what they used to do with the MK Ultra. And look, we're not idiots. Yes, they got busted in the mid 70s with MK Ultra. Do you think they really stopped? That just showed them how to get better at covering up their tracks. I mean, we don't know half the stuff that DARPA is doing right now, and they've really got their hands deep into stuff. So,
yeah.
You know, I certainly don't pretend to know what actually happened, but the official story is a bunch of crap, and it's like the same thing with the Bin Laden death, a bunch of crap. Same thing with 9/11, it's a bunch of crap. And thank goodness people who are brave and involved. I mean, even John Farmer with 9/11, this is the guy who is the senior counsel to the 9/11 commission, wrote a whole book called Ground Truth, talking about it's a load of crap. But he's saying what I'm saying. He's saying, I don't know what it is. I'm not Alex Jones saying, oh, it's an inside job, and pointing the finger at Cheney. But it certainly warrants a real investigation. These are very serious crimes.
We have a little less than 5 minutes left in this segment. I made a wild-eyed accusation, and so I'm gonna say it now, and I'd like for you to explain to me what kind of a fool or an idiot that I am. I said that we had kind of been set up for something. We had been set up to believe something, and that if Ron Paul had gone to the Republican convention, and the delegates had a chance to come onto the floor, and the strategy would have worked its way out, and Ron Paul would have been the nominee, we would have seen a lone gunman. And we would have believed it because America has already been set up this year to believe that. So now, does that sound like the crazed ramblings of an idiot, or do you think that might have actually possibly been a plan?
We don't know. I mean, unless that you've got some inside source or something, we don't know. That said, given how, my knowledge of the history of the United States, especially its kind of surreptitious nature and some of its black chambers, from the NSA to the FBI to the CIA and all that, and how they operate, I would think that's a prudent perspective. I would certainly, if I were Ron Paul and had all the money from Campaign for Liberty, I would have had the convention not been completely manipulated and fraudulent, and let's say Ron Paul had gotten the nomination, man, I would have the most, I would spend all my money on my security detail, because I do agree with you that they at that point, they would have been very freaked out, freaked out. The establishment you're talking about, and I'm talking mostly about central bankers.
And they don't like to give up power.
Nobody does. This is not controversial. I mean, we've got Lord Acton just saying that power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. What do central planners and central bankers do? They centralize. And there's been this movement to centralize power since the beginning of time. The history, unfortunately, of human history is largely the history of slaves and their masters. And there's been these twinkling lights from kind of the Magna Carta and some Taoism was very libertarian and leading up to the revolution with the Bill of Rights. I'm not a fan of the Constitution. I'm not one of these, I understand it as a strategy and whatnot, but I don't fetishize. I don't have a fetish for the Constitution. I do have a fetish for the Bill of Rights, the anti-federalist. But these documents in the history of liberty, they are anomalies in themselves. They are very unusual. They are outliers. And what's scary is that there is a tendency in statistics, there's something called mean reversion, where data tends to trend back towards the mean. And the mean of human history has been slavery, one of servitude and the, you know, the throat under the boot kind of thing. So, you know, I think that I am optimistic because largely because of the internet and technology and markets. But that doesn't mean I'm not cautiously optimistic for the chances for liberty in the future.
And that's a good way to segment into the next section that we're going to do. Let me pause and we'll have a quick commercial here and I'll save this file and we'll be right back in about a minute and a half with Jake Shannon. I'd like to talk to you about Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom. The Liberty Classroom is a collection of courses on history and Austrian economics presented in an easy, convenient way. There are video files and audio files you can download. You can participate in discussions online in the discussion boards. And there are live sessions with Tom Woods and the other educators where you can directly interact with the instructors. Now, who is this for? It's for anyone who realizes that they didn't get the real story in government-approved schools. It's also great for homeschoolers and unschoolers. Join Tom Woods and his team, and they'll equip you with one of the very best tools the Liberty Movement has to offer, knowledge. Real knowledge in a usable form. At Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom, you can get all this for only $99 a year. Now that's less than the cost of one movie DVD a month. This gets you access to absolutely everything on their site. All the courses, plus additional courses that'll be added later, the discussion forums, the live sessions, everything. So how do you do this? You go to badquaker.com. You click on the banner for Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom. By using that link, you'll let Tom know that I sent you, and you'll help badquaker.com. Thank you very much.
Gun Training with the Non-Aggression Principle, Volume 1. Basic Handgun and Rifle with Jared Waltz.
First rule of being alive is you own yourself.
A groundbreaking approach to firearms and self-defense training. Beautifully filmed and easy to understand instructions make this one a must-have. Gun Training with the Non-Aggression Principle, Volume 1. New DVD from Michael W. Dean. Available on Amazon.
And I'm back with Jake Shannon. My name is Ben Stonis on BadQuaker.com podcast. And in the last segment, we talked about hypnotism. And we talked about Jake's book, The Hypnotist, Healer, Head Hacker, and Headliner. And right now, Jake, I want to ask you about your latest book, which is Endonomics. Tell me about this book and what is it about?
Well, it's kind of funny because, you know, at the beginning, you rattled off all the books that I've been involved with and I've published and all this kind of stuff. And it's really funny because Endonomics, which is my most recent book, it's really the book that's in my field of my professional and academic background. The other ones are books that I am passionate about and frankly I'm just completely absorbed in. That is liberty and hypnosis and epistemology and philosophy and things of that nature. But I felt it was a duty to write this book. I am a longtime libertarian. I've been libertarian since probably 1994. And I used to be kind of your typical coffee shop pseudo-intellectual, you know, Marxist, blah, blah, blah. And I had a college roommate, and I just could never win an argument. And I always I sympathize with these people on the left because you think about it being about, oh, well, I want to win, and it's a contest. I didn't realize that the reason he kept winning is because his arguments were more congruent with reality, you know? And once I finally conceded that point, I became libertarian. My undergraduate's in English, and I think that's why I do write so much. But my graduate degree is in financial engineering. And financial engineering is this discipline that's relatively new. It's basically financial economics on steroids. It's mostly the mathematical part of financial economics, okay? That's kind of the Krugman the engineering, the using a lot of math, a lot of ideas from statistics, from, you know, about risk and standard deviations and things of that nature. And then you go from there, and then it's a little creative. You start creating synthetic securities, and a lot of them that are rather notorious, like credit default swaps or interest rate swaps or things of that nature. So I worked in that field after graduating. In 2002, I worked at Financial Engineering Associates, which is a highly regarded financial engineering firm in Berkeley. And I worked there for a while, and then I got picked up and I worked in a boutique investment banking firm for a while. And then I ended up working at IndyMac Bank. I got picked up, and my title, I mean, you don't get a more convoluted sounding title when you're a financial engineering. My title was Manager of Technical Oversight for Complex Instruments. I mean, you can't just rattle that off. You can't even really put that on a business card, but they did somehow anyway. I worked there at IndyMac Bank, and IndyMac Bank was the first bank to get nationalized during this credit crisis.
Right.
And I had left because I was privy to their stuff. And if you go to my LinkedIn page, you can see all my colleagues were like, oh, Jake was totally trying to raise his hand. He was very vocal about all this kind of stuff. And I just didn't want to be a part of it. So I left, and I ended up working in reverse mortgages. I developed some of the modeling that is responsible for valuing what are called reverse mortgage servicing rights. I was instrumental in developing probably the biggest model that had ever valued those assets. And then I talked with my boss in the metrics department, and we decided to leave. We started our own firm. It's called Reverse Market Insight. It is now like the leading consultancy in the reverse mortgage space, and it's still out in Orange County, California. Long story short, I've been long time in this liberty movement. I understand Austrian economics. I don't know that I'd say I'm an expert. I didn't get my PhD like some people do, but I've really studied this stuff and I understand it. And I understand financial economics as well. I understand some of the public choice economics, the libertarian economics, and I also understand the more kind of establishment economics. And so my problem was that through social media and my radio show that I have, I kept finding that people in the liberty movement were stuck. They seemed to, because they're smart people and they want to study and they take the effort and they do it on their own. And they seem to understand how inflation works. They understand that fairly well, how the Federal Reserve inflates and all that. But they never understand this idea of deflation, okay, which is very much within the tradition of Austrian economics and the Austrian business cycle, the boom and bust cycle, which Ron Paul always talks about, that the credit expansion then is followed by this bust. Well, the bust is deflationary, and mm-hmm. we are in a deflation now. And so it's been almost like banging my head against the wall to try to get good-natured, smart libertarians to grasp the fact that we're actually in a deflation. Everybody's like, oh, we're having a hyperdeflation, blah, 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 blah. Well, I'm sorry, we're not now, and we probably won't. We'll end up looking a lot like Japan, which is has a Bank of Japan, like a Federal Reserve, and they've been 20 years in a deflation. So that was part of the reason why I started the book. I also thought that I needed to explain how derivatives work and how they're a problem. So I guess there's this tendency in me to break things into three in my books, okay? And I guess I'm guilty of doing that. The first section is on deflation and how that actually works. The second section of endonomics is on default, which is an inevitability. We will default on the debt. We will repudiate the debt. That's an inevitability. Anybody who says otherwise is not dealing with reality. And then the third part is that about derivatives and how they actually work. The failure of Keynesian economics and how Keynesian economics really led to the development of these credit default swaps almost by necessity, and how regulation has failed. Not only these credit default swaps, but how regulation has led us to create this situation where collapse is almost inevitable.
What do you envision the United States looking like after that takes place?
Okay, so in the book, I do call myself an apocalyptic optimist, and that's because, you know, look, economics has been labeled the dismal science, and sometimes that's justifiably so. I can understand that. And my name of my book, Endonomics, is like taking that up a notch. But it really is an optimistic book. I could call myself an apoco-optimist. There's a very interesting guy named Johan Galtung, and he's the guy who is responsible for kind of launching the peace studies movement in academia. Very interesting guy, and he has a very pithy saying that I like to repeat, and that is that the end of the American Empire, which I peg the date to be 2025, give or take 5 or 10 years. Well, I have 5 years on either side, so from 2020 to 2030. But he says that the end of the American Empire will be very good for the American Republic. And I agree with that. This is why I'm optimistic. We will collapse under the weight of our own debt, just like the Soviet Empire, just like the British Empire, just like the Ottoman Empire, just like the Roman Empire. I mean, it's inevitable. We've spread ourselves way too thin. However, I'm very optimistic because look at Ron Paul. Look at the people he's inspired. That demographic is young. And in the 15 years or the 10 or 15 years that it will take for the collapse to finally happen, and it could happen earlier. There could be other straws that break the camel's back, like if the petrodollar got yanked or something like that, which is not unrealistic. If you Google bilateral agreements, you can see that the press doesn't want you really to realize that. But this is why we're going to war with Iran, because Iran's entering into bilateral agreements and cutting out the petrodollar.
Right.
But anyway, I think it's actually going to be great. I think that we have a very alert and alive and awake youth. And a lot of the people in the military that are young and will eventually take positions of power support liberty and the freedom movement. And I'm very optimistic that when that collapse comes, those people, if they're prepared and they're brave and they have the guts like Ron Paul not to sell out, I think that we could really see a real strong reemergence of the ideals in the Bill of Rights, of the Anti-Federalists, of this, you know, strong republic where individual rights are valued across the board. So I think it could be rough for a little while, you know, just like when the Soviet Union collapsed. Yeah, you won't have your trash picked up. The roads might not get repaired. That's not permanent. It's not going to turn into, in my opinion, Mad Max or anything like that. It'll be a little uncomfortable, but ultimately, just like the collapse of the Soviet Empire was great for the Russian people, now they got cell phones. They got, instead of one car that they can buy, they got like 50 different choices they can get. And that's what'll happen with us. Just like the British Empire, when it collapsed, you know, they used to say the sun never sets on the British Empire. Well, now it does, and it's good. They've actually got one of the strongest currencies in the world. And so I think it goes for us. While it sounds maybe apocalyptic, and I play a little bit into that just to sell the book, to be frank, but I am really optimistic. I think it's actually we're in an amazing time as long as the people really are ready to lead.
A lot of people have looked into the future, and they are looking at the possibility of an actual breaking up of the individual states or at least regions within the U.S. What do you feel on that area?
Yeah, you know, look, nobody has a crystal ball. I think it's plausible. I certainly think it's plausible. I mean, for anybody who's ever been to Europe, you get this different sense because, you know, they talk about like Italy and Spain and all this, and you get this coming from the United States, you have a different sense. Those are basically the size of states here, and they're all independent states. And it's all that different than how the original idea of our federal union was supposed to be, where the independent states can do their things. And we still give lip service to the 10th Amendment. But look, the war on drugs is a perfect example of that. I mean, you have like California where pot is legal, and they still, the DEA and the FBI are still harassing people. So what I'm hoping is that when this collapse of the federal government comes, is that the people will be ready and they'll be ready to lead. I mean, even Wyoming has legislation right now in the works to be ready for this kind of thing. One of the big fears I have is when the collapse comes, there's going to be two things that we have to really watch out for. The first is people like the IMF and Basel, the Bank of International Settlements and whatnot. These are the central bankers' bankers. That I hope that they don't come in and seduce the people with this concept of special drawing rights, because then we'll have like a world central bank. That is a big problem. The second thing we have to look out for are these continuity of operations that the federal government, these plans that they have, like Rex 84. This is the stuff like Ollie North that he was working on. where basically people are freaked out that when the collapse comes, there'll be martial law. Those are kind of the two things that we need to right now that we know that we perhaps have a good 10 or 15 years to prepare. This is the kind of stuff where activists need to be aiming their attention at. I can understand the Fed, you know, and the Fed. I'm all for that. And actually in the book, Endonomics, I put out a wish that I hope that Endonomics eventually becomes the study of how to end central banking, how to withdraw from it, how to defend against it. But I think that we really need to be focused not on the Federal Reserve, but more on Basel, more on Switzerland, more on the IMF, the World Bank, those kind of guys, because they're going to come in acting like the shining knight to rescue us when the collapse comes, and that's the wrong way to go. And the other one is domestically this continuity operations type of stuff, this Rex 84, that will totally it's not like the bill is so great as it'll be pretty much if that stuff is implemented.
Our connection is kind of coming and going there for a second. I lost the last couple lines of what you said.
Oh, what was the last part? And I'll hopefully I can get closer to my router here. Well, what we have to do is I understand liberty activists. Excuse me. I think I understand them fairly decently, being one myself and having been involved in this movement. And I've never seen it more alive in my 20 years, at least, of being involved with libertarianism. I've never seen the ideas more accepted than they are now. And by the way, am I coming through better now?
Yeah, that's much better.
Okay,
yeah.
Good. What I think, though, is that liberty activists need to be very, very aware of the chessboard. I think they're just looking a move ahead. I think we need to be looking way down the chessboard better, okay? And this is from me coming, again, with my background in finance, my you know, 2 decades in with liberty and looking at how this has played out. We need to be looking at the world central bankers. We need to be looking at the IMF. We need to be looking at the World Bank. We need to be looking at the Bank of International Settlements, not the Federal Reserve, because that's what's going to happen. This, in my opinion, is why the EU, the European Union, which is central banking, is collapsing, and why the Federal Reserve is collapsing at the same time, because I think they want to collapse the world financial system to come in, these world central bankers, and say, oh, well, we'll protect you with this concept called special drawing rights. You can Google that, just SDR. So that's the one thing. We have to be looking out for the world central bankers trying to centralize. That's what they do. Central planners centralize even more, and they want to create. And I don't like getting into this jargon of new world order and all that kind of crap, because I think it discredits us. But there is this globalization movement, and the central bankers would like that. They would like to have that control where they have this world currency. China is pushing for it as well. So I hope we don't succumb to that. And the second thing is liberty activists have to be very cautious. Like I said, I'm optimistic, but you have to be cautiously optimistic. We have to look out for also, in addition to these world central bankers, we have to also be looking out for these continuity of operations things, this Rex 84 stuff. Again, you can look that up on the internet. They have contingency plans for when the federal government collapses, and we have to make sure that the good guys, our friends and our allies inside of the military and inside of law enforcement, never turn the guns inward towards us, that they need to keep them pointed outwards against the enemies, and that we don't allow martial law and just respect and peace and freedom to go the way of the dodo. I think those are if we really keep our eyes on the world central bankers like in Basel, Switzerland, and we keep our eyes on these continuity of government, these martial law things, I really do think the collapse of the American empire will be great for the American Republic.
Yeah, and this is like you indicated there. We're not talking tinfoil hat conspiracy theory, you know, monsters in some French chateau with hooves rubbing their hooves together with little right. horns. You know, what we're actually talking about is statists, people who believe in this system. They believe that central banking is good and it's a profitable system, and they probably believe that because it works for them. You know, that's how people tend to make decisions. So it's not necessarily some kind of wild-eyed conspiracy. It's just the taking something to its logical end. If people in power believe that the state is good, which they do, then they're going to take these actions most likely to continue what they perceive as the best way there is to do stuff.
Yeah, and it's very funny because, you know, we opened up talking about hypnosis. And, you know, as a hypnotist, all I have is language. I don't have pills. I don't have potions. I don't have voodoo or psychic powers. I have language, but language is powerful because this is the difference between looking at this realistically. Like if you use the language of New World Order, blah, 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 it hypnotizes the people listening into thinking you're a whack job. However, right. If you talk about and you use the language of globalization, of Basel, Switzerland, of G20, then all of a sudden you're talking the same thing, but then the language is better understood and respected. It's like chemtrails. If I say chemtrails, people look at me and are like, dude, you're an idiot. But if I talk about geoengineering, which is the exact same thing, this is the power of words and jargon, and we have to be alert to it. These are real things. You have to respect, and again, I, for lack of a better term, I call it conspiracy evidence. And that is this simple, common sense notion that, yes, people in power are pretty much no different than you and I, Ben. They've got their own secrets. They have their own aspirations and dreams. The problem is a lot of times they don't have empathy for other people. That's kind of the difference, is they're not okay with training other people to get that. And that's what we have to just recognize and again, have that kind of mental self-defense.
We're going to pause right here and save this file and let you have an opportunity to hear another one of our lovely commercials. We'll be right back with you in just about 30 to 45 seconds. Hang on, we'll be right back. Would you like to do something to support BadQuaker.com? Here's how easy it is. If you're already going to buy something from Amazon, go to BadQuaker.com first. Click on any of the buttons for Amazon. Once at Amazon, shop like you normally would. You'll pay the same price for the things you buy from Amazon, but Amazon will give BadQuaker.com a tiny portion of that purchase. It's amazingly easy to shop at Amazon, it won't cost you any extra, and you'll be supporting BadQuaker.com. Thank you. Jake Shannon's with me from Mental Self Defense Radio. And speaking of self-defense, Jake, you know a lot about a lot of kinds of self-defense, not just physical, not just mental self-defense, but physical self-defense too, don't you?
Well, you know, it's interesting because, you know, everybody's got something that they've been into. You know, once you get a certain age, you've got a couple different skills. Well, I think that, you know, my skill set, I've got probably about three or four things. There's an interesting field of study. It's called expertise acquisition theory. It's this guy out in Florida is kind of the main guy, Erickson. But there's other, you know, famous economists like Herbert Simon and whatnot have been involved in publishing on this. But the long story short is that it takes about 10 years of deliberate effort, typically. Deliberate effort. I mean, like, you're seriously doing this kind of activity all the time. It takes about 10 years of deliberate effort to become an expert at something where you really know what you're talking about. You have maybe 10,000 hours logged of effort in this area. And for me, that is hypnosis, that is libertarian political theory, that is finance, and that is self-defense, in particular, grappling or wrestling, not the WWE style, but the you know, competitive style. I started wrestling when I was about 4 years old. My mom put me in wrestling and the little peewees, and I've been involved at some level ever since. Well, I am a bit of a serial entrepreneur, and I started a company in 2003 called Scientific Wrestling, and we sell DVDs, like instructional courses on how to wrestle.
Unfortunately, at this point, Skype let us down, or the internet let us down, or whatever, and our connection just turned into a lot of metallic-sounding gobbledygook, and we really couldn't get anything out of it. So Jake and I had to disconnect our connection, and took a few minutes, and we reconnected everything. And so we kind of restarted the conversation because of the interruption. It seemed better to just restart it completely. So rather than lose any of the earlier part, I just left the earlier part in and just tagged on the where we restarted at. So I hope you enjoy this. I'm sorry for the interruption. Here we go, back with the podcast again. The most interesting man in the Liberty Movement, Jake Shannon, host of Mental Self-Defense Radio. And on the topic of mental self-defense, Jake, let's talk about physical self-defense.
And I appreciate that. I'm probably going to use that now. I'm going to have to probably get that trademarked or something. I don't know. But I will always give you full attribution. That's awesome. But to this concept, you know, so I have a radio show. I call it Mental Self-Defense. It's a broader concept that I'm trying to brand, to create a kind of a meme or whatever you want to call it these days. But it unites all my different things that I'm particularly passionate about, or that I have maybe a little bit of insight or some expertise or whatever. And that's, you know, libertarian political theory. I've been libertarian for going on 2 decades now. Self-defense. I've wrestled since I was about 4 years old. And been involved in grappling and submission wrestling and things of that nature, hypnosis, and also finance and economics and some social engineering concepts. So I kind of wrapped it all together into this concept of mental self-defense. But, you know, so central to that is this concept of self-defense. I think that is integral to being libertarian. It's what differentiates us from pacifists. That is, I look at being a libertarian as being a pacifist that will punch you back.
Yeah, well said.
And I think that's important, right? Because the right to self-defense, this, you know, thing that we all talk about with regards to the Second Amendment to the Constitution, that is a defining property. It means, you know, when we talk about libertarianism, a lot of times it's this derivative principle, the non-aggression principle. It's more specific than harm principle, insofar as that we say that we're not going to mess with anybody. We're not going to start any altercation, but you mess with us, we do reserve the right to defend ourselves in kind. And I think that's central to libertarianism.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with that. You know, and that's that even on my being a bad Quaker, that's the main thing that separates me from Quakers, is that most Quakers are pacifists, and I'm not. I mean, I believe you have an obligation to yourself and your family to defend yourself.
I think pacifism is a very, very noble goal. My problem is that not everybody else is pacifist, you know, and that's the problem. So when we do come across a pacifist, it's a win-win. It's awesome. This is where free market kind of interactions, peaceful interactions are born. But when we come across somebody who does, there are bad people. I mean, 1 out of 100 people are psychopaths. And that doesn't mean all of them are violent psychopaths. We find a lot of them in white-collar positions, from corporations to government to politics and that kind of thing, obviously. But there are violent people in this world. And we do need to be able to protect not only ourselves, but also our property. If somebody is taking our property or whatnot, you really invite, I think, you encourage violence with pacifism. I think that's the nice thing about the libertarian philosophy, is that, like I said, it's a pacifism that will punch you back.
I was just going to add that, you know, and that carries us right into martial arts, because martial arts is really, you know, if you get kung fu movies away from your thoughts and you realize that martial arts is really about self-discipline, and it's not about, you know, I've heard somebody say it was a fantasy fight with your daddy because you were abused some way, but it's not that at all. It's really about self-discipline and putting your body and your mind in a position to defend yourself. Isn't that about right?
Yeah, no, I mean, I know that, you know, clearly I think Stefan Molyneux has been saying things to what kind of what you're speaking to directly. And I can tell you that I'm a lifelong martial artist. I've had no connection in any way to child abuse. I was not abused as a child. You know, I just, that kind of thing, that gets into kind of the stuff that drives me nuts about the Liberty Movement, the kind of the Ayn Rand level of reasoning, where you just make these stupid bombastic statements and it discounts all the brilliant stuff you said prior. That kind of thing is just, that is, I don't know. I don't know a better word than ridiculous. I mean, it's just, it seemed more to me like a psychological confession to the person saying it, more of like a Rorschach test type of thing than anything else. I mean, self-defense is just a necessity in a world that is not comprised of pacifists. And we don't live in that world. We live in a world of where there are violent people, and we do need to protect the things that we own and the people that are near and dear to our hearts. I mean, it's just it doesn't even seem controversial. So, you know, I, with regards to people that make those kind of claims, you know, I honestly can't even take it serious. It almost I feel like my IQ dropping just even trying to address that kind of question.
I like that.
Well, I mean, I don't think it's controversial. I mean, you know, we live in a world where there are Dick Cheneys who will shoot you in the face with a shotgun when you're his buddy. I mean, what kind of, you know, weird Emperor Wears No Clothes universe is it where you can make these outlandish statements about defending yourself is not a good thing, especially within the liberty movement? I mean, it's really mind-boggling. But, you know, sometimes people get to a certain level and there's this echo chamber, and unfortunately the echo is their own worldview, and they just get a little lost. But, you know, that's the thing. There's nobody that's perfect. I mean, look, so I disagree, say, with, say, Stefan Molyneux, who I've had on my show. He's a nice guy. I think I agree with him on so many things. But that is at the heart of it ridiculous. But guess what? Ron Paul, I love Ron Paul. The guy's brilliant. But, you know, him standing behind the Defense of Marriage Act or, you know, this anchor baby kind of legislation, yeah, not so cool. But, you know, we're quibbling on the little stuff when, by and large, these are the greatest guys. Like, I give Rand Paul a tremendously hard time. But the fact is a guy like Rand Paul or Mike Lee, guys that I do hold their feet to the fire on my radio show all the time, they're the best senators that we have, if for those people who come from a liberty perspective. So, you know, I don't like to create factions or troubles within the liberty movement, because I think we need to spend more time uniting than dividing. But yeah, I mean, sometimes there are ridiculous statements like that. Like Peter Schiff. I think Peter Schiff is a good guy. I think he's very wrong in a number of issues on the economy. But hey, you know, so what are we going to do? You know, I ultimately hope that people can keep their eyes on the prize, you know?
Yeah, and I really think that is critical. We absolutely have to, because our enemies, politically speaking, our enemies pick out things like this and mock us with them.
Yeah, I mean, to say that anybody who practices the martial arts has daddy issues, that's, I mean, it's just ridiculous. I'm like sitting here literally with my face in my palm, like literally. Like, it's just, I can't even get my head wrapped around how stupid that is to come from somebody who I do think is a smart person. But, you know, I'm sure I say plenty of stupid things, too. So, I mean, it's just, but that is really nonsense.
Yeah.
I mean, well, from a libertarian perspective, it is about aggression, ultimately. So to pretend aggression doesn't exist and that you shouldn't defend yourself and that if you do, you have some sort of hang up is anti-libertarian at its core.
Yeah, it really is. Because, you know, not everybody can live in a perfect neighborhood and not everybody can have, you know, a perfect environment of people around them at all times that are, you know, you're in Salt Lake City. That's one of the probably one of the safest major cities to live in the U.S. But even in Salt Lake City, there's places where you can suddenly find yourself where you need to have an awareness of your environment, and you need to have a confidence. You need to have practiced certain things so that you have a confidence to know that if something turns bad, you have control.
Well, Salt Lake City is very safe. I actually moved my family when we started having kids. My wife and I were like, we're out of L.A. and out of Orange County. We're moving to Salt Lake for a lot, largely because of that reason. But yes, you're right. Like, Elizabeth Smart was abducted in Utah, which is a very safe area. So, I mean, maybe it could have been differently had Elizabeth Smart practiced some sort of self-defense or had situational awareness and not been abducted. Now, she was a young lady. I'm just using that as an example. She's went through a horrible ordeal. But yeah, I mean, it's total nonsense to pretend that it really is so anti-reality and so anti-libertarian. It's really difficult for me to even grasp where this could come from or the motivations. I just don't get it.
Let's recap your books really quick for later listeners that may have come in on the radio and didn't hear the first part. On the topic of martial arts, which would be the first book that they should get of yours?
Well, you know, a lot of the ones that you rattled off were some of my earlier books. I think probably the best with regards to at least my area expertise in martial arts, because there's many, many martial arts. My expertise is in Western-style martial arts, and in particular on the grappling side. And that would be probably the Say Uncle book. So if they went to like Amazon and they typed in Say Uncle and then my name, Jake Shannon, it would pop up. And that was a pretty good seller. I think it was a bestseller in both the mixed martial arts and the wrestling. I think we got as high as number 4 in both of those segments for Amazon's ranking. So that one sold pretty good. And then kind of a bullet point on the other books, my most recent one is Endonomics. If you just type endonomics.com, it'll take you right to the Amazon page. And that's talking about why I am predicting the end of the United States Empire by 2025, and kind of explaining to people deflation, debt default, and how derivatives have led us to this precipice. And then the book prior to that was my book on hypnotism. It's called The Hypnotist, Healer, Head Hacker, and Headline, talking about the medical applications of hypnosis, talking about the antisocial applications, things like programmed assassins, and as crazy as that sounds, the real facts, again, not from crazy conspiracy websites, but from Freedom of Information Act documents largely. And then the last section, headliner on the obvious, you know, comedians and stage hypnotists and the history therein. And then I've also got my Teocon book, which has been very well received. I was fortunate to have Dr. David Gordon, PhD. He's a PhD in intellectual history. He's a senior fellow over at the Ludwig von Mises Institute. He wrote the foreword to it. And it was the first book actually published on the Tea Party, the modern Tea Party. And I predicted, and the data has confirmed, that the Tea Party started out as a libertarian movement but was co-opted by the establishment GOP and turned into basically a wing of the GOP, that they were in sociology the term is recuperated. And before that was my book on it's called Anomaly, and that's on epistemology, or the theory of knowledge, anomaly, revolutionary knowledge in everyday life, and largely touches on how do we know what we know, how can you divide conspiracy theory, which is largely usually nonsense, from conspiracy fact, how can you live a better life. And I show in there it's important for us to be wary of these centralizing paradigms, that paradigms, these convictions that people have, oftentimes are very wrong, and we need to be looking at the unusual things, the data points, the anomalies, as guideposts, if people are really, truly concerned about having a fidelity to reality and to knowledge, to true information. So that's kind of the books in a nutshell. I also ghost wrote a biography of a very famous pro wrestler. That one is also fairly recent. It's called Physical Chess. You can get that on. And he's a very famous guy, Billy Robinson, a famous mixed martial arts coach and pro wrestler and such. So that's kind of it in a nutshell. Quite a number of them, I know.
Jake, I really appreciate you coming on the show. I want to, again, express an open invitation. Anytime, you know, we chat on Facebook now and then. Anytime you have something you want to come on the show, just drop me a note and we'll make it happen. And I really appreciate you coming on with me today.
Hey, no, I had a great time, and definitely we'll certainly do this again. And maybe we can get more in depth on a couple of these issues.
Yeah, it would be nice to just narrow down on one and just tackle it for the whole hour. Folks, for more on liberty, property, and the Zero Aggression Principle, go to badquaker.com. Thank you very much for listening today.